Still eating. You can join me in 1 Samuel 21. We're starting a new chapter today in David's life, and we're doing that in a couple of different senses. Practically, in our study through David, we've come to a new chapter. Just finished chapter 20 in our last study, but this chapter also, in a thematic sense, is introducing a brand new chapter in David's life story. An important transition is taking place at this point in David's life. Just to briefly remind you, what's happened in the story up until this point is that David has had, if we were to look at David's life in an overview from a big picture perspective, looking at his entire life, David's life has several important segments, several chapters as a whole. And so far in his life, we've covered two of the chapters of David's life, and we're starting chapter three, in a sense, of his life story. The first chapter was his early days before he knew what the Lord had planned for his life. The days of preparation, days of quiet service in the house of his father as he grew up as the youngest son in the household of seven sons, and he was a shepherd, and he was responsible to, you know, basically be the gopher for his father and his brothers. And that chapter in his life was redefined when unexpectedly the prophet Samuel showed up at his father's household one day, and by the direction of the Lord, a horn of anointing oil was poured out on David's head, and Samuel the prophet announced by the word of the Lord that this young man was being set apart by the Lord to one day be king over Israel. But we've seen that David, once Samuel announced, this is the king, David didn't immediately become king. It just starts a new chapter in his life. The second chapter is the one we've just been engaged in for the last few months. That's the chapter of David leaving his father's household, leaving the personal comfort zone of his family, and entering into directly the service of the king as he's become the right-hand man, so to speak, the number one servant, the personal assistant of Saul the king. And that began with a very special event that we're all familiar with, the special opportunity that the Lord gave to David to represent him and represent the kingdom of God in the battle against Goliath, and the great victory that David won by faith over the Philistine hero. And as David wins that battle, he becomes the hero of Israel. He becomes the shining, rising star in Israel. And he's appointed to be not just now the personal assistant of Saul, but he's appointed to be one of the military leaders of the army. And he wins battles on behalf of the Lord and on behalf of Israel and on behalf of Saul. But in the process of doing that, as David's star rises, Saul, who is not doing well in his walk with the Lord, and he's deteriorating and getting worse and worse as he's drifting away from the Lord into deeper and deeper rebellion in his heart struggles with the requirements of the Lord upon his life. Saul sees David rising and takes it not as a good thing, a holy thing, a thing that is serving the Lord's purpose, but Saul sees David's rise only from the perspective of how it's going to affect him personally. And he sees David's rise as a threat to his own position, to his own kingdom. And so he launches into this mode of wanting to eliminate David, to remove the threat to his own position of power and authority. We've seen Saul attempt to kill David at least three times now, twice personally with attempting to pin David to the wall with his own spear, and a third time by having his personal guard go to David's house, surround it to arrest him and to kill him. And David has escaped each one of these circumstances. And then where we ended in the last chapter is that this all comes to a head through the interaction of Saul's son Jonathan, who is more loyal at this point to David than he is to his own father. The reason being not out of sin in Jonathan's heart, but because Jonathan is more loyal to the Lord than he is to any man. And he sees the hand of the Lord upon David's life, and he sees the hand of the Lord being removed from his father's life. And so he shows covenant loyalty to David and connects his heart and his life to David in covenant friendship that's going to bind them in a relationship of loyalty for the rest of their lives. And at the end of that last chapter, what David has decided is he has to now leave the household and the palace. He has to leave the proximity to Saul. He's attempted, because the Lord had led him there. The Lord had sent him there. He's attempted to remain close to Saul, but now it's just become impossible for him to remain close to Saul because Saul only has evil in his heart toward David. And so David's going to leave, and this, it begins a new chapter in his life. And this is the chapter number 3 of final preparation for the calling of God in his life. And his call is to one day be king. So this is going to be a final phase that the Lord has appointed for David. Last tests that David is going to have to pass through in order to be qualified, not just externally by circumstances, but internally by the development of his character to be king. This is a pattern that we're going to see over and over again in David's life, but it's a pattern that applies to every single man of God. It applies to my life, it applies to your life. And that is, as we've talked many times before, God has a calling in your life, just like God had a call upon David's life. You're not called to the same thing David was called to, but your calling is no less significant because it's God's calling. Whatever his assignment for you, that's between the Lord and you. But the fact that he has laid his hand upon your life for his purpose and has placed his call upon your life as a result of his hand being upon you indicates that he has a purpose for your life, something specific, something of significance that he wants to accomplish in this earth through you. And in order to accomplish that work, there is preparation in your life that needs to be done in order for God's will to be fulfilled through your life. And there are circumstantial arrangements of things that God is going to work in your circumstances to get you from where you're at now to where you need to be in your situation in life in order for you to fulfill that assignment. Those are the external workings of God in your life circumstances, like we see God working in David's life, moving him from one place to another, one set of relationships to another, one situation to another. But the bigger issue and what God is really at work to accomplish is the heart preparation that's necessary, the character development that's necessary in order for you to fulfill the plan and purpose of God for your life. David will never be the king that God has called him to be if his heart isn't prepared to accept and walk in that role, to handle the weight of that responsibility once it's actually placed upon his shoulders. We saw, and we're still seeing in the story as it's unfolding, how Saul cracked under that weight of responsibility of the kingship. And the Lord doesn't want David to crack. The Lord wants David to be the king in a way that no one has been before then and how no one will be after him. He's going to fulfill a very special role in the plan and purpose of God. And so that requires special preparation for that work. So this chapter, chapter 21, begins what is commonly referred to as the wilderness years of David's life, meaning that he's leaving Jerusalem, where the palace of the king is, where the comforts of the life that he's known are. This isn't the first time in David's life that he's had to leave something familiar and something comfortable and venture out into unknown territory. We've already seen how the end of chapter 1 of his life leading into chapter 2 meant that he had to leave the comfort and the familiarity of his father's house to go and be Saul's servant. Now he's leaving the comfort and the familiarity of Saul's house, and he's venturing out onto his into his own new territory, into the wilderness. He's never been in this situation before, and it's going to present unique challenges to him. And the greatest challenge is going to be, he's going to be in a leadership role over these next few years as we see the next phase of his life unfold to a degree that he's never been in before. In his father's household, he was always under his father's authority. He was always in a position where his father just told him, go here and do this. And David's only job in life was just listen to your father, pay attention, and obey whatever he tells you to do. And if he did that, he would be honoring the Lord, and he would be fruitful and effective and faithful in his life. And then when he left his father's household, he was under Saul's authority, and really all he had to do was pay attention to what the king ordered him to do and faithfully carry out the orders of the king. Now, having left his father's household by the Lord's call, having left Saul's household by the Lord's call, he's going to be out on his own for the first time in his life. This is the great transition into full manhood for David, where he is going to be the one making the decisions. He's going to be the one taking charge. And because of that, he's going to be the one that's going to be bearing the brunt, the responsibility, the accountability for the decisions that he makes. He gets the credit when he makes the right decisions, and he gets the blame when he makes the wrong decisions. And what we're going to see in these years to come is he makes plenty of both. We're going to see wonderful examples of him making wise, righteous decisions and the good fruit that results. But we're going to see even in this chapter, in the immediate portion right in front of us, where David makes some unwise decisions and handles things in the pressure of his circumstance in the wrong way, and some disastrous fruit is the result. So let's read from chapter 21. I'll just read the first 10 verses this morning. It says, then David came to Nob to Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech came to meet David, trembling, and said to him, why are you alone and no one with you? And David said to Ahimelech the priest, the king has charged me with a matter and said to me, let no one know anything of the matter about which I send you, and with which I have charged you. I have been made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread, or whatever is here. And the priest answered David, I have no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread, if the young men have kept themselves from women. And David answered the priest, truly, women have been kept from us always when I go on an expedition. The vessels of the young men are holy, even when it is an ordinary journey. How much more today will their vessels be holy? So the priest gave him the holy bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, which is removed from before the Lord, to be replaced by hot bread on the day it is taken away. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's herdsmen. Then David said to Ahimelech, then have you not here a spear or a sword at hand? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste. And the priest said, the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you struck down in the valley of Elah, behold, it is here wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it, for there is none but that here. And David said, there is none like that. Give it to me. And David rose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. All right. The very first thing that happens is David flees in his final leaving of the household of Saul, leaves the city of Jerusalem as he travels to a town called Nob. Now, Nob was significant at this point in history, not because it was such a great town that was well known in other parts of the story of the Bible, But just because of the role that it was fulfilling at this particular moment in history. Nob was a little town just about 5 miles north of Jerusalem. So when David left Jerusalem that day, having said his goodbyes to Jonathan, he didn't have far to travel. You know, he went about 5 miles, and he went directly for the town of Nob. Now, most likely, he didn't arrive here by accident. Most likely, he arrived here on purpose, chose to go this direction. The reason Nob was significant was because right at this point in history, this is where the tabernacle of the Lord was located. Now, the tabernacle of the Lord was intended to reside in the city of Jerusalem. And why it was in the city of Nob at this point is not exactly described clearly. But the indications are it has something to do, most likely, with the condition of Saul's heart before the Lord. Where Saul is in Jerusalem. That's where Saul lives. And Saul, as the king of Israel, should have been responsible to make sure that the tabernacle of the Lord was well kept, well cared for, and was where it belonged, which was in the city of Jerusalem. As later, we see as the story unfolds later in David's life, David is used by the Lord in a very special assignment to take the plans for the construction of a permanent dwelling place, a home for the Lord, a temple of God that his son Solomon is later going to build in the city of Jerusalem. But the fact that the tabernacle is in Nob, which is some 5 miles removed from Jerusalem, is kind of an image. It's a practical description in symbol that God has removed himself from Saul, meaning the house of God is not in Jerusalem where it belongs with the king. It's actually disconnected by some 5 miles of distance, which just displays for us how distant the Lord has become from King Saul. But David is not distant from the Lord. David is close to the Lord. And so when David is fleeing Saul, where does he flee? The very first place David goes in his flight from Saul is he flees to the house of God. He flees to God's house at Nob. And he goes seeking the presence of the Lord. There's a portion later in the New Testament, we won't turn and read it right now, we'll read it in a minute, but where the Lord Jesus actually refers to this event in David's life and applies it to an event in the life of his own circumstances, in the life of Jesus. And he describes what goes on here in this circumstance, in this interaction between David and Ahimelech. And even though it's not mentioned here, one of the things that took place is that Ahimelech sought the Lord on behalf of David while David was there. It wasn't just that David went there and got some bread and got a sword and left. He sought the Lord through Ahimelech. Now, who was Ahimelech in this story? We only have a little detail mention of him here, and I'll fill in some of the gaps. But what's the one significant detail we have to identify Ahimelech here? He's the priest. And of course, who are the priests? The priests are those Levites that God has set apart for special service. Their assignment is to remain close to the house of God, to the tabernacle at this time, later the temple, and to serve the Lord in his house, to function, to carry out all of the practical needs of the house and all of the activities involved in the worship of the Lord in the house of the Lord. Now, Ahimelech is not just a priest, he's a special priest. Even though it's not identified here, we know from earlier testimony in the scriptures that Ahimelech is, at this moment in history, the high priest in the house of God. Ahimelech is the great grandson of Eli, the high priest that we saw that actually trained the prophet Samuel, who had anointed David to be king over Israel. So Ahimelech is the high priest. He's the one in charge, by God's design, of the tabernacle of the Lord. So David comes to Nob, he comes to the tabernacle, and he encounters Ahimelech, the high priest, there. And Ahimelech has an interesting response when he sees David. In verse 1 it says, Ahimelech came to meet David, trembling, and said to him. Now, who's trembling? Is it David or Ahimelech that's trembling? It's Ahimelech. Now, David's the one that's fleeing Saul. You would think that David would be trembling, but David's not trembling because now he's relatively safe because he's just escaped from Saul. It's Ahimelech that's trembling. Why would Ahimelech be trembling when David comes to meet him? Number one, Ahimelech knows who David is. David's famous. It would be like meeting some high official in the government of the United States and you've seen him on TV your whole life. You know exactly who this is. Ahimelech, as the high priest, was well familiar with King Saul. He was well familiar with the high officials in the court of King Saul. And David was second only to his son Jonathan, was the next highest official in the court of the king. David was known throughout Israel. They had been singing songs throughout Israel praising David and his great victories on behalf of Israel. So Ahimelech knows exactly who David is. Why would he be trembling in this circumstance? The indications are it's this battle that's been ongoing between Saul and David is not a hidden thing any longer. It's well known. It's well known that Saul wants to kill David. And yet, at the same time, David is the leader of Saul's army. And there's this issue between Saul and David that's spilled out into public awareness. So he arrives here at the tabernacle, and he shows up alone. And that's unusual, because as the commander of the army, normally he would have a whole troop of soldiers with him. And so there's something unusual going on here. Ahimelech picks up on the fact that there's something out of the ordinary that's occurring. He's just not sure what's going on. He's trembling because he's not sure what this is going to mean for him and whether there's going to be trouble or there's going to be problems that are going to unfold next. So he says to David, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" And how does David answer Ahimelech, the high priest of the Lord? The high priest of the Lord, of course, represents to the people of God, all of the covenant people, represents whom? Who does the high priest represent? The Lord. This is the Lord's. The Lord is represented on earth throughout the old covenant by three main roles at any moment in history. He's represented first and foremost by the high priest. He's represented by the king of Israel, and he's represented by the prophet of God, because those are the three primary roles of the Lord himself in all of his interactions with his people. The Lord himself is our great high priest. He is our king, and he is our prophet. And so at this moment in history, Ahimelech represents in a very significant, in a very special way, the Lord himself. And so here is the Lord's representative asking David at a critical moment in his personal history, and he says, in asking him a direct question, representing the Lord, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" And David answers the Lord's representative in what way? What does he say to him? He just lies right through his teeth. It's not even like I'm adding a little bit of unnecessary details to kind of shade the story a little bit. He just flat out lies. There is nothing true in what David says to Ahimelech. He says to him, "The king has charged me with a matter and said to me, 'Let no one know anything of the matter about which I send you and with which I have charged you. I have made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place.'" And then he makes his request. Nothing he just said to explain to Ahimelech what's going on and to answer Ahimelech's question is true. All of it is 100% a lie. Now, we've talked about, in an earlier study in David's life, the very difficult but true biblical principle that there are special circumstances under which God authorizes his people to lie. You remember that we talked about that? In that there are certain circumstances in which, when you are dealing with a clearly wicked person whose only intention is to take innocent life, that it is allowable for the sake of protecting innocent life to lie to that wicked person, and that the Lord does not consider that lie to be a sinful lie. Is that what we're dealing with in this case? The answer is no. Because David's life is not being threatened at this moment. Yes, Saul is threatening his life, but that's behind him in Jerusalem. Saul's nowhere in the vicinity. And Ahimelech is the priest of God, is not authorized, and David knows this, to take the sword against David. Even if Ahimelech, because David doesn't know at this point whether Ahimelech is actually loyal to Saul or loyal to him. He's not sure where he stands with Ahimelech. But Ahimelech is called by the Lord to not stand for Saul or for David. Ahimelech is called to stand for the Lord. In other words, he's not to take up arms against David no matter what. So David's life is not being threatened by Ahimelech in this circumstance. He's not under the pressure of imminent danger to his own life. But he chooses to lie anyway. And so his lie is what we would identify as a lie of personal convenience. That is sin. So we're going to see examples as we continue through David's life. He's not a perfect man. There's a perfect calling upon his life. But the way that he handles his calling, the way that he walks in his calling is not always perfect. You know, we have glorious examples of David, you know, trusting the Lord in incredibly challenging circumstances, like with Goliath at a younger point, at an earlier point in his life. And we'll see examples in the future of him trusting the Lord. But at this moment, who is David trusting in? At this moment, David. And it's an interesting mixture. Because I just said a few minutes ago, when he flees Saul, where does he flee? He flees to the house of the Lord, which is a good thing. You know, if you're in trouble, go to the Lord. Go to church. Get your help where you need it, where the Lord has appointed for you to get your help. But as soon as he arrives there, it would be like, okay, he's in a crisis. He needs some help, so he goes to church. He's going to talk to the pastor, and the very first thing out of his mouth is he tells the pastor a complete lie. And why? Because he's just not sure what the guy is going to say back to him. And so he wants to just, at this moment, he just wants to get some practical help. He wants to get some bread. He wants to get a sword. And he wants to get on his way. And so David is struggling at this point. He's got a mixture of motivations. Some of his response in his trial, in his present test, is good, and some of his response is not good. And this is the case where David is leaning on himself. When we lie in a sinful way, and you can just be really clear about this, what you are doing at the moment that you tell that lie, that kind of lie, is you are trusting in yourself. And you're not trusting in the Lord. The Lord leads us to speak the truth, even when it may cost us something, even when it may put us in a difficult position. But the idea is, if we tell the truth and we do it as unto the Lord, we're trusting that he'll cover us, he'll watch over us, he'll keep us, and that he will honor our truth-telling. What David is doing in this circumstance is he's basically forgetting the Lord at this critical moment, which is kind of strange. I mean, he's in the house of the Lord talking to the high priest of God, and yet he's forgetting to trust the Lord at this key moment as this new chapter is beginning. So he tells this story to Ahimelech, and Ahimelech's not terribly discerning about the story that he's been told. He just accepts it. And he should have known better, because before the conversation is over, David tells a second lie to Ahimelech, and the second lie exposes, if Ahimelech could have just seen it, exposes that the first story that David told him was a lie. The second story was what? As he goes on to say to Ahimelech, he's asked Ahimelech for bread, and the story that David tells Ahimelech is that the men that are with me, and there's no one that's actually physically there talking with Ahimelech alongside of David, but the indications are from later in the story that what's happened is when David left Saul, he brought a small group of servants with him. But apparently he left them somewhere away from the tabernacle, and he walked up to the tabernacle to meet with Ahimelech by himself. So the other men are somewhere in the wilderness behind him. And Ahimelech says to him, look, I will give you some bread as long as the men who are with you are ceremonially pure, because this bread, I'm only going to give it to ceremonially pure people. And David answers him with an additional lie by saying to him what? The men that are with me have gone through this whole process of purifying themselves ceremonially. There's no indications in the story before this that those men had done that. So now he's lying about religious ceremonies in order to just get the bread that he wants to get. Then later, he asks Ahimelech for a sword or a spear or some other weapon. And when he asks him for that weapon, he gives him the reason why he needs a weapon, because David's not carrying a weapon with him. And do you remember what the reason is? Or you can look in the story. Why is it that David says he needs a weapon? It was urgent. I had to leave. The king sent me away so quickly. I didn't even have time to take my weapons. Now, number one, that doesn't make sense. When the king sends you, you're going to have time to stop and grab your sword if you're being sent on some military purpose. So Ahimelech should have discerned this just from that alone. But the idea that he didn't have time to take his sword, but his men had time to purify themselves ceremonially, is a glaring inconsistency in David's story. What this points out to us is just the nature of lying. And you guys have already experienced this in your personal life. When you've struggled with the temptation to lie and you've crossed that line and you've lied, what tends to happen when you lie is it's hard to keep track of your own stories. And you'll say one thing to cover yourself with a lie, and then you'll get further down the road and you'll tell a second lie, not realizing that your second lie just exposed your first lie. And you think that you're being smart to cover your bases in all these different ways, but the Lord is exposing what you're doing as a lie. And so that's what's going on here with David. Even though Ahimelech doesn't discern the lie at this moment, we can be confident that the Lord is exposing it. And that's the case, is the people around you that you're telling the lies to will not always pick up on the fact that you're lying. You might get away with lying to a particular person, but you can just be confident of this. The Lord, who's called you to be a truth teller, will inevitably expose your stories. He will bring it out. So it's just better to stay away from lying, because you don't want to have to go through that embarrassment of the Lord exposing you in that public way later. All right, so he asks Ahimelech first for bread. That's because David's motivated by a very practical need. Now, is there anything wrong with David's request? He's asking for bread. The answer is no. There's nothing wrong with his request. He left the household of Saul, the comforts of Jerusalem, and all of the provisions that were in Jerusalem. He didn't have time to stop and pack a picnic lunch for himself or to stuff a backpack full of food. He left without anything, and he's going out into the wilderness where there's very precious little provision for him and for the men that are with him. And so he needs food. There's nothing wrong with his request. What Ahimelech answers him is interesting, though. Ahimelech first says to him, "I have no common bread." Now, what does he mean by common bread? The normal bread anyone would use to eat. The bread that everyone would normally have in the house to eat for their personal sustenance. He says, however, I don't have any common bread. I do have only the holy bread. Now, what he's talking about here is what is known in the Old Testament as the showbread that was displayed on a daily basis in the tabernacle of the Lord, in the house of the Lord. This was the bread of God. It was part of the law of God. It was part of the requirements of the tabernacle. One of the priests, and actually there was usually a team of priests that were responsible for this, they were to, every week on the Sabbath day, or in preparation for the Sabbath day, they were to bake fresh bread. Does anybody remember how many loaves of fresh bread they were to bake? It's not critical that you remember, but there's an important symbolic purpose to it. They were to bake 12 loaves. And those 12 loaves represented the 12 tribes of Israel, and the Lord's provision in his house for each of the 12 tribes of Israel. They were to take those 12 loaves and they were to display them on the table of showbread in the house of God. Remember, as you walk in the house of God as a priest, you're going to walk in the front door through the curtains of the tabernacle. And on the left side, you're going to see the lampstand, which shines light on the tabernacle. And on the right side, the first piece of furniture in the house of God that you're going to encounter is the table. It's God's dining room. And on that table, God wanted this bread, this what was called here by Ahimelech, that bread of presence, literally the bread of face, which represented the person of God, the provision of God, as he calls himself, the Lord Jesus does later when he arrives, the bread from heaven, God's provision for his people. And so that bread was to be displayed on that table. Once a week, they were to bake this fresh bread. Then on the Sabbath day, what was to happen is as that bread was baked, they were to take the old bread, the old 12 loaves, off of the table, replace it with new hot bread. And what was to be done with those 12 loaves that came off the table? Does anybody remember? The Levites, only the priests who were actually serving in the tabernacle were to then take that old bread and consume it, to eat it for their own provision. They were never to just throw it out for the birds to eat or give it to hungry people in Israel. Only the priests that were set aside for this special purpose were to eat that bread. So when Ahimelech says, I don't have any common bread, what he's saying is, I don't have any bread in my own personal cupboard that I can share with you. All I have is the tabernacle bread, which normally would be interpreted as an absolute no answer. I don't have any bread to give you. But what is David's response in this circumstance? He's basically saying, okay, I'll take that. I'll take the tabernacle bread. Now, at first glance, we might think that what David does here is wrong. At first glance, it might seem like, because is David a Levite? Is he a priest in the tabernacle? No, he's neither. He's from the tribe of Judah. He's not from the tribe of Levi. He's not been consecrated and set apart as a priest. Nevertheless, he takes the bread and Ahimelech gives it to him after David tells him the lie about the fact that they have been ceremonially consecrated just as godly men. He takes the bread and he eats it and shares it with the men that are with him later. Now, let's turn over to the New Testament. We'll come back to 1 Samuel. To Matthew chapter 12, and we'll read how Jesus addresses this circumstance when he refers to this exact same situation. Matthew 12, I'll read the first 8 verses. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." What was the Pharisees' issue with what was going on here? What did they say was unlawful? The work. And the work was that the disciples were reaching over as they were walking through a grain field and grabbing heads of grain and plucking the heads of grain and then shucking the grain off of the stalk and just popping that grain, like raw wheat, for instance, into their mouths and chewing it just because they didn't have anything to eat that day and they were hungry. But what they were doing was technically work. And technically it was against the law. It was violating the law, which required no one to work on the Sabbath day. The Pharisees saw this happening. Someone had observed it. And when they heard that his disciples were working on the Sabbath day in order to feed themselves, they confront Jesus about this, and they're expecting to be catching Jesus in a ceremonial violation of the law of God because, you know, they've got their own agenda. They're looking for ways to undermine the credibility of Jesus in the eyes of the community. What's interesting is how Jesus responds to this. He doesn't respond with an acknowledgement that they're right. You Pharisees are right. I'm so glad you pointed that out. You know, I'm going to have to rebuke my disciples. This was just so wrong for them to violate the law of the Sabbath in this way. What he responds with is a rebuke to the Pharisees and an explanation that what his disciples have done is actually allowable and is actually lawful in this circumstance, even though it's a technical violation of the ceremonial aspect of the law. Let's read on. So they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." And he said to them, "Have you not read what David did?" Now, when Jesus refers to David, he's referring to 1 Samuel 21 and David's visit to Nob and receiving the bread from Ahimelech, the high priest, the table of showbread. He said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God." Now that confirms for us the detail that was missing from the story in 1 Samuel 21. That when he went to visit Ahimelech, he went to the tabernacle of God, to the house of God, which was located there in Nob. How he entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which it was not lawful for him to eat. Now what Jesus has just said is, what David did is he broke the law. He broke the law. But what he broke was not, and this is the critical part, and this is the point that Jesus is making. David did not break the spirit of the law. He broke the ceremonial requirement of the law. And there are certain special circumstances, which this circumstance with David is one, and the circumstance where Jesus and his disciples are another, in which the spirit of the law may, in certain special circumstances, come into conflict with some of the technicalities of the law. And in those situations, it's critical for us to be able to discern what is the spirit of the law. What is it that the Lord is really after in this situation? What serves God's higher purpose in this circumstance? And so he says, he entered the house of the Lord of God and ate the bread of the presence, which it was not lawful for him to do, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests. Or have you not read in the law how on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guiltless? What he means by that is the fact that the priests are replacing the bread on the table on the Sabbath day by the commandment of God is actually violating the law not to work, because it's work for them to do that. And yet God himself built into his law some technical violations of the law in order to honor the spirit of his law, in order to show this principle to his people. And Jesus discerned that, but the Pharisees were just caught up in the technicality always. They just missed, they were so ingrained in the letter of the law that they missed the point of it, the spirit of it. So he says in verse 6, "I tell you, something greater than the temple is here." Now, the something greater than the temple is Christ himself. And if you had known what this means, now he's quoting from a later prophet, "I desire mercy and not sacrifice. You would not have condemned the guiltless, for the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." What Jesus is just simply saying here is that, look, I made the law. And if my disciples were eating grain on the Sabbath day, and it was under my observation that they were doing so, and I've authorized them to do so, then you can be confident and be certain that what they were doing is right. And what is the spirit of the law that supersedes in what his disciples did, the technical requirement that they not reach over and pluck that grain? The spirit of the law is the Sabbath was created for the benefit of man. The Sabbath was created by God. It was ordained by God in order to create a day where man could rest in comfort and remember his God and worship his God. But the fact that his disciples were hungry, had not had anything to eat, would not have had the strength to continue their journey without that necessary food, superseded the technical requirement not to reach over and do that little bit of work to pluck the grain from the head and to pop it in their mouth and eat it. And so the point that Jesus makes is that the purpose of the law was fulfilled, the spirit of the law was fulfilled in their eating it, even though it was a technical violation of the ceremonial aspect of the law. In the same case, in the same way, that's why he refers to the David incident. What David did in requiring or requesting the tabernacle bread and taking the tabernacle bread and eating it was not a sin. He sinned in his lie, but he didn't sin in his request or in his eating of the bread. And Ahimelech was at least this wise, that he didn't withhold that bread from David. Ahimelech provided the ceremonial bread, knowing that it was a violation of that ceremony, but it served God's greater purpose to provide for the actual need of David. And the other thing that we need to see in this, and this is just a symbolic thread running through this, is that by David eating the bread, what he's doing is he is representing a greater David. There is a greater David behind this whole story. And that is that Jesus is later identified by his own words. He calls himself, one of his great titles that he applies to himself is he refers to himself as the Son of David. That's a title that Jesus applied to himself. And so David here is representing the greater one than himself, the Lord of the Sabbath, who is not bound by the ceremonial technicalities of his own law in order to fulfill the greater need at the present moment of personal sustenance. All right, so let's go back to the story in 1 Samuel 21. We'll finish up with two last details. The next thing that is just dropped into the middle of the story, and it has no immediate significance, but it's going to have great significance in the next chapter, chapter 22, when we get there next time, or maybe two studies from now. And that is, there's another character in the story that's introduced here, and he's just kind of a background character at this point. Reading in verse 7 of 1 Samuel 21. Now a certain man, this is while the conversation about the bread is going on between David and Ahimelech. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, meaning he was there for some ceremonial purpose. People would often go to the tabernacle of God to receive some blessing from the Lord, to seek the Lord, to offer a sacrifice of some nature. And his name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's herdsmen. Now, why is that significant? Well, what's going to happen, and I don't want to get too far into the story, but just to give you a quick preview, what's going to happen is Doeg observes Ahimelech feeding this bread to David and giving, in a moment, the sword of Goliath to David. And he's going to go back to the court of Saul because he works for Saul. And he's going to tell this story to Saul. But he's going to tell it to him in a shaded way that's going to be to his own advantage. And Saul's going to become enraged that Ahimelech, the high priest, who he sees not as the servant of the Lord, but as the servant of Saul. And he's going to become enraged at Ahimelech. And this event is going to cost Ahimelech his life for having fed David that bread and having provided that sword to David. As Doeg is later going to kill Ahimelech for what happens that day. And what's an interesting detail in chapter 22, before we get there, is that David says, as he hears the report of what has happened after Doeg slays Ahimelech, David says, I saw Doeg there that day, and I knew he was Saul's servant, and I knew he would go back and tell Saul what had happened when Ahimelech fed me the bread and gave me the sword, and it's my fault that he lost his life. It's my fault that this has happened. And so while David isn't sinning by taking the bread, the sin is the lie that he's told, which leads Ahimelech to make these provisions for him. And the result of David's lie isn't immediate as it happens in chapter 21. But what we're going to see is that the pattern of David's lying has a disastrous consequence for Ahimelech, and not just Ahimelech, all of the priests that served in the tabernacle that day, along with Ahimelech, were killed by Doeg the Edomite. 85 men lost their lives because of David's actions on this day, with one exception, which we'll see later on. One of the priests escapes. All right, so Doeg is there, but at this point, he's just the quiet, kind of like in a mystery story. He's the guy in the shadows. He's the guy just observing what's going on here, and he's going to run and tell Saul later, but he doesn't act at this point. Then for the rest of the story, after David receives the bread from Ahimelech, he has one other practical need, and that's the need for a weapon. Now, it wouldn't be ordinary for a priest to necessarily have a lot of weaponry around, but David's desperate, and so he asks Ahimelech, do you have anything? Do you have any kind of weapon, a sword? Do you have a spear? I don't have my weapons with me. He tells that additional lie. I was in a hurry. I had to leave on this assignment. I didn't take my weapons. Do you have anything? And what Ahimelech answers him as he says, the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you struck down in the valley of Elah, behold, it is here. This is an interesting description. It is here. And where is here? The tabernacle. It is here, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. Why would it be wrapped in a cloth? And what is the ephod, and why would it be behind it? What is all this describing here? Why would, this is the questions that are asked in the story that we need to ask. Why would the sword of Goliath be in the tabernacle of the Lord? It didn't belong there. Why would it be wrapped in a cloth? What is the ephod? And why is the sword placed behind the ephod? What's going on here? Okay. It was a great victory. It was in recent history, it was a symbol of the greatest victory of the armies of the Lord against the armies of their enemies, the Philistines. But even though it was a great symbol of victory, if it was in anyone's house as a symbol of victory, it should have been in the king's house in Jerusalem, or possibly in David's house. Could have kept it as a personal memento. Have you ever kept some memento of, like, any of you guys have any sports victories in your younger, healthier years where you kept a trophy, you know, and you look at that trophy fondly and you have a tear come to your eye because you remember how victorious you were in battle at some point in your younger life? Maybe David could have appropriately kept the sword of Goliath in his household. And David is the last one to use this sword. Remember, what was the last time this sword was used? Chopped the head off of the giant. He slew the giant with the five smooth stones in his bag, taking out that one stone destined by the Lord to win the battle, and he slung it and slew Goliath with the stone. But he went and took the sword of Goliath out of its sheath after he had fallen and cut the head of the giant off. We saw that was the hand of the Lord to demonstrate to all of Israel the finality of the victory of the Lord. But it's interesting, David doesn't take that sword home with him. That sword, we don't know the backstory. We don't know how it got there from David's hand on the battlefield to wrapped in a cloth in the tabernacle of the Lord under the care of Ahimelech in the tabernacle at Nob. How does it get from one place to another? Well, we can be confident it didn't end up in the king's palace as a trophy, even though it was the victory of the Lord and ultimately the victory of Saul, because he was the king over Israel. Why didn't it end up in Saul's palace? Because from day one, he's jealous of David. He doesn't want anything to remind him of the victory of David. But it is interesting to me that it doesn't end up in David's personal home. It ends up in the tabernacle, which makes it more of a religious artifact and not in a good and healthy way. And that's the connection to the ephod here. What is the ephod? Does anybody remember the ephod? It's kind of one of those unusual, yes, that was the special garments that the Lord ordained in the law for the high priest to wear. That's Ahimelech at this point in time. But he doesn't wear it all the time, day and night. He only puts those garments on when he's going to enter the tabernacle after special cleansing and consecration to actually do his responsibilities as the high priest of the tabernacle. The rest of the time, the ephod remains in the tabernacle. It's set apart, it's special, it's holy. But now the sword of Goliath has been wrapped in a cloth, which indicates special care. We're taking care of this. This is something very, very important to us. And it's placed behind the ephod. It's not supposed to be anywhere near the ephod. It's not the sword of a pagan Philistine hero, even though it was used by the Lord through David's life, is not meant to be in the tabernacle of the Lord. The Lord was very specific about what he wanted in his house and what he didn't want in his house. He had certain items of furniture that were to be there, nothing else. The Lord kept a very simple and direct house. He doesn't want other stuff filling his house. Okay? And yet, there's an indication here that not all is right, even in the way that Israel is conducting its worship of the Lord. What is absent from the tabernacle, what should have been there, but what wasn't there, is there's no Ark of the Covenant in the tabernacle at this time. There's only an ephod. The reason the Ark of the Covenant is not there, we won't go into the whole backstory, but at an earlier time, during the days of Eli, who is the great grandfather of Ahimelech, during those days, because of Eli as the high priest's unfaithfulness to the Lord, what has happened is the children of Israel are defeated in battle by the Philistines. And when they're defeated in battle by the Philistines, the Israelites have the bright idea to bring out the tabernacle of the Lord to the battlefront. And if we have the Ark of the Covenant with us, we'll win the battle because the Ark of the Covenant will overwhelm our enemies. And because they're not right with the Lord, they bring the Ark of the Covenant out, but they're defeated even worse by their enemies, and the Ark of the Covenant is captured and carried away into the Philistine territory. It stays there for a period of time, and then the Lord severely judges the Philistines, and they say, we got to get rid of this thing, take it away from us, and they put it on a brand new cart and send it, led by oxen, without any person connected to it, away from them, and the Ark of the Covenant is taken by the Israelites that receive it, and it's placed in the house of Amminadab. We'll see that later in the life of David, because David's assignment, one of the great things he's going to accomplish, besides being the king of Israel, David is going to be the man that the Lord will use to restore the Ark of the Covenant to the house of the Lord. At this time, the Ark, which represents what? The throne presence of God. The throne of God is disconnected from the house of God, which just indicates to us that at this time, because the king is not in right relationship with the Lord, Ahimelech is not doing great with the Lord, the whole nation is disconnected from the Lord. The Ark of the Covenant is not in his house, and the house of the Lord is not in Jerusalem, the city of God. Everything is out of order. Everything's out of place. And the Lord is going to use David to ultimately restore order. He's going to bring the tabernacle into the city of Jerusalem, and he's going to bring the Ark of the Covenant into the tabernacle. And ultimately, under the kingship of David, everything will be set in order. And that reveals the work, the greater work of Christ. It's in the work of Christ that everything that was out of order in God's creation will ultimately be set back in place as it belongs. But at this point, what's interesting is the sword of Goliath, which doesn't belong in the tabernacle, gets where it does belong. And where does the sword of Goliath belong? In the hands of the one who earned it in battle. And so David takes the sword from where it doesn't belong to where it does belong, which is strapped to his side. And it becomes now David's sword from this point forward in his life. He uses the sword of Goliath to accomplish great victories as the Lord leads him on into the next chapter of his life. All right, well, we'll stop there for this time, and we'll pick up with David continuing journey through the wilderness as he flees down to Gath, which is in the territory of the Philistines. We'll pick that up, Lord willing, next time.